Okay. Now, the next article is from the San Francisco Examiner for Monday, December 1st, 1980. Okay, so this goes back a while. The headline is, Klansman says teaching tots about warfare means survival. Dateline Birmingham, Alabama, UPI Wire story. A Ku Klux Klan leader says teaching guerrilla warfare tactics to children as young as 8 may be a key to the survival of the white race. Quote, there will be no Pearl Harbors for the white people of this country, unquote. Louis Beam, Grand Dragon of the Texas-based Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, said during the weekend, quote, we will be ready. Beam was one of 50 Klansmen attending a national leadership conference at the Birmingham Jefferson County Civic Center. He said the Klan's use of paramilitary training camps was, quote, nothing worse than the Boy Scouts. Instead of playing baseball or out kicking a football around, they are learning how to survive, he said. We have taught children how to wring the neck of a chicken and cook it. So what is so bad about that? Beam said a third survival camp will open in Texas early next year. He said two others, including one near Anahuac, Texas, have been operating for 5 years. Quote, we are operating just as legally as the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, or U.S. Army, he said. We are no worse than the Boy Scouts. Beam said men, women, and children as young as 8 are being taught the basics of weaponry and survival. Quote, I would even like to start them a little younger, maybe at 6, because I believe young white boys are capable of handling it at that age, Beam said. We do not mean to train anyone to promote racial warfare, but it is realistic to assume that it could happen. We could find ourselves in a situation where our government is threatened, unquote. Beam refused to say how many people are taking the training, although he conceded it was a relatively small number. He said, quote, numbers aren't important, unquote. If you want to talk about numbers, look at how the people on the Mayflower felt with 3.5 million savages waiting in the wilderness, he said. Don Black, Alabama Grand Dragon of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, said his group has no paramilitary camps, but he defended their purpose. Quote, the issue is survival of the white race, Black said. We want to take America back from those who stole it, unquote. Another KKK faction led by Bill Wilkinson of Denham Springs, Louisiana, operates a paramilitary camp near Cullman in North Alabama. Okay, well, this is a rather interesting article in a series of ways, and several things need to be looked at. Beyond the fact, once you get past the rather interesting logic of somebody having to take America back and give it back to the white people who've lost it, which I don't think anybody could really be able to wander their way through that minefield of logic too easily, the more important things in terms of what we're talking about tonight are as follows. First of all, notice again, Louis Beam, Grand Dragon of the Texas-based Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Again, Louis Beam is, for all intents and purposes, running the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan right now, while the titular leader, also mentioned in this article, Don Black, is in prison because of the Dominica coup already talked about.
I think Black is actually out now. I think
is he out? Oh, yeah. I believe you're right. I do remember that. I think we actually read it on the air. Bill Wilkinson, of course, his name crops up again, a Louisiana Klan leader. We talked about him earlier in the broadcast. Another thing that's interesting to look at is that, first of all, on one hand, you can see that many of these leaders have been, in fact, Klan leaders for a long time and have been a long time. They've been involved with this kind of stuff for a long time. On one hand, this suggests that their connections go back a long ways, which we have been examining as we've gone along. On the other hand, it might tend to suggest to the casual observer that the Klan is essentially an organization made up of old men and people who are living in the past, et cetera, et cetera. Well, when you put this article together with the fact that Don Black and Louis Beam and these people are intimately involved with the Order and the Hayden Lake Aryan Nations groups, and if you've ever seen, for instance, the documentary that they did on KQED on the Order, you realize most of these guys are about 19, 20, 21, 25 years old. Then, also, you put in the context of this article where they're talking about children as young as 8, and if Louis Beam has his way as young as 6 being taken out, and what in fact you have is something that goes, that is basically the same as the Hitlerjugend. You have a group of young people who are going to be taken out and trained long before, as is supposedly attributed to the Catholic Church. They say, give me your children until they're, what, 5 years old and they're mine forever. And apparently the Klan feels the same way. So we have a rather sophisticated group of people who are not only connected into the military and espionage complexes of our country very strongly, as we've examined, but they're also on a wholesale basis training new generations of young people to believe in this fanaticist philosophy. And at the same time, unlike, I suppose if you wanted to call liberalism or progressivism a countermanding philosophy, nobody is taking the liberals and the progressives out into the desert and teaching them how to wield Sten guns and Uzis and to blow up power stations like they're doing with the KKK, folks. And when push comes to shove, if it ever does come to shove, and if they in fact incite this race war that they're talking about, they will have a definite advantage.
And again, perhaps the most ominous thing, not only parallel to the Hitler Youth, which Nip talked about, but the fact that overall, lurking behind all of these characters appears to be government sponsorship of one type or another. Now, we've looked at that with David Duke. We've looked at it with the other members of the Aryan Nations group in our other broadcasts. We've looked also at government connection with a Klan lawyer named Robert Chambliss, or rather Arthur Haynes, who defended a Klansman named Robert Chambliss in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. Haynes connected with both FBI and CIA and an attorney for James Earl Ray, among others. And this pattern of government sponsorship of Klansmen, and again, we're comparing the Ku Klux Klan wing of the Aryan Nations with the Nazi Party in Germany as basically an underground extension of the military. If you get tired of that phrase, my apologies, but that's we're bringing it up so often to try and familiarize people with what admittedly is not only a distasteful concept, but a pretty strange one in the context of late 20th century America, at least to most people's way of thinking. Now, recall Bill Wilkinson, the not member of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, but head of the Invisible Empire. That's probably the other... If you hear about the Ku Klux Klan, you're probably either hearing about the Invisible Knights or the Invisible Empire or the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And Bill Wilkinson is head of the Invisible Empire. Duke, Black, and Beam are from the Knights. And we're going to give you an interesting piece of information. Remember now the government connections to these various people. Recall now that Adolf Hitler got his start as an undercover informer for the Reichswehr and was infiltrated into a defunct political party, then the National Socialist Party, which was then revived to provide a front for German military intelligence. We're going to play now another section from a Hard Rain tape, this also dealing with a series from the Ku Klux Klan. And remember now the apparent government status of David Duke and his connections to Black and Louis Beam of the Aryan Nations. We're going to talk about Bill Wilkinson, and Bill Wilkinson also is an informer for the FBI. And this particular Klan leader is a leader of one of the largest and most powerful Klan factions, a man named Bill Wilkinson, last name W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N. Following article appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Monday, August 31st of 1981. It's an AP story headlined, Klan Leader Linked to FBI as Informer, Dateline, Nashville, Tennessee. According to a confidential memorandum, Ku Klux Klan leader Bill Wilkinson became an FBI informant in 1974 after being assured his anonymity would be protected, the Nashville Tennessean reported yesterday. In a copyright story, the newspaper said the KKK Imperial Wizard acknowledged that he had provided information to the FBI during the last 7 years. But the newspaper quoted Wilkinson as saying that he told agents only what he had told reporters. They were trying to groom me as an informant, Wilkinson is quoted as saying. But all I ever told them was my policy, and my policy is that I would only tell them what I would tell the news media. Wilkinson said the reason he always has, and still does give the FBI what information I can, unquote, quote, is that I am convinced that that the Justice Department and the FBI is necessary. I want to demonstrate to them that I am not out violating the law, and we have no intentions of doing so. And I have felt that by giving what cooperation I could, that I could demonstrate our good faith, Wilkinson said. The internal FBI documents, which originated in the New Orleans field office in which the newspaper said it had obtained under the Federal Freedom of Information Act, said Wilkinson was unwilling to testify in open court. According to the Tennessean, Wilson said he never received special favors or money from the Justice Department and denied ever providing names, addresses, or other information about his Klan followers. The Tennessean said Wilkinson became a government informant when he was a member of David Duke's Knights of the Ku Klux Klan faction and remained so after he formed his own Klan faction, the Invisible Empire, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, the fact that yet another major Klan leader is connected with the U.S. government as a, in essence, a U.S. government agent, an FBI informant, is very interesting here. Wilkinson, as I said, is a leader of one of the most powerful and violent Klan factions, and it's particularly significant that it became a Klan informer when he was a member of probable U.S. government agent David Duke's Klan faction, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay, and that was, again, a short segment of Hard Rain. You will notice that no, Dave was not on any cough medications or anything like that. It was just a slightly slow tape, and the voice sounds a little different. Again, as noticed, Wilkinson's involvement with the FBI. Now, one of the interesting things about Duke and Wilkinson and the aforementioned Frank Camper and the Frank Camper paramilitary schools and his involvement with the FBI is not just a sort of a general thing of, paramilitary right-wing fascists linked up with the intelligence services, but the fact that in many occasions, and one notable one we're going to talk about, that things have actually happened that have pointed directly at the involvement of informers. A notable case that we're not going to talk about in any depth is the death of civil rights worker Viola Liuzzo. We talked about that to some extent on the last Radio Free America broadcast. A woman who was shot by a bunch of Knight Riders in a car, among whom was a government informant, and one of the other Knight Riders, in fact, suggested the government informant pulled the trigger. Even more recently and more savage, actually, and terrifying was the events in Greensboro, North Carolina. Now, this took place in November of 1979 when a mixed racial rally, an anti-Klan rally, was going on in a black neighborhood, a mixed racial rally made up of not only different racial groups but different political groups. The rally was essentially crashed by a group of 40 Klansmen and Nazis. A gun battle started in which, of course, the Klansmen and the Nazis had virtually all the weapons, and five Communist Workers Party members who were part of that anti-Klan rally were shot dead. And the people involved in that shooting were, in fact, acquitted twice, and the only conviction in that case has come several years later. Last year, I believe, that those men were actually convicted of violating the civil rights of the aforementioned dead people. And again, you can figure that one out, but they were acquitted by North Carolina juries twice, despite the fact there was videotape of them shooting unarmed people at virtually point-blank range. Now, on the tape coming up, and in some of the ensuing articles, we're going to be discussing the involvement of the FBI and the police force in terms of tracking the movement of these people, and we're going to be examining, not in as much depth as we have at other times, but we'll be examining the question of what did the establishment, I guess, to use an old-fashioned word, know, and when did they know it, and what did they intend to have happen?
Okay, again, now this whole pattern of government agents is not only disturbing in and of itself, particularly disturbing because of the parallel with Nazi Germany. Again, Hitler was an agent, where the Nazi Party was a front in its inception. So as we see, Duke, Black, Lewis Beam, and now Wilkinson, who, although he heads up a separate group now, got his start as a government agent when he worked for David Duke. It's worth remembering that the kinds of activities that we're going to be examining right now, and that Nip just described, with the murder of some communist union organizers down in Greensboro, and neither Nip nor I obviously hold a brief for that sort of politics necessarily, but the fact of the matter is, under our Constitution, people are supposed to be able to have freedom of assembly, and they're supposed to be able to organize without being shot dead. It represents a fairly serious breach of our civil law.
And in truth, it has to be said that the Klan and the Nazis have the right to civilly assemble and to discuss their goals, however repellent we may all find them to be. But what we are talking about, folks, is not civil meetings and is not getting together and mouthing racist slogans. We're talking about a paramilitary milieu, which means we're talking about guns, we're talking about robbery, and we're talking about murder wholesale, and this is just one small example of it.
Now, the thing that made the Nazi Party, the thing that really won it its political merits in the eyes of the dominant people in Weimar Germany, was its anti-communism. The Nazi Party, remember, an intelligence front in its inception, was used basically as a vehicle for suppressing not only the political left, but all democratic forces in Weimar Germany, and the kinds of activities that made it popular with the dominant industrialists in Nazi Germany, or in Weimar Germany, were the activities putting down communists, and specifically people who would organize the workers. And the Greensboro shooting, in which five communist union organizers were shot and killed by a combined Klan and Nazi faction, which appears to have been organized and led by government agents, is particularly ominous. It is a direct throwback to the events of Nazi Germany. And the thing to remember is that if, or to the extent, I should say, that the Ku Klux Klan, the Nazis, the Aryan nations can offer themselves up to the American public as the antidote to the communist menace, to that extent they're going to become very popular and live down their well-deserved unsavory reputation.
Okay, and as we mentioned before, this is another Hard Rain broadcast dealing with specifically some of the strange connections involved in the Greensboro case and how they came out.
To light in a number of different sources. The documentary source we're going to use here is a New York Times article reprinted in the San Francisco Chronicle. The New York Times story here in the Chronicle is headlined, Police Links to Klan and Nazis Charged. It's datelined Atlanta, and it was run in the Chronicle on Saturday, October 3rd of 1981. Not going to read you the whole story, but just a couple of small sections of it. Of Ed Dawson and his role in organizing the Klan and Nazi motorcade for the Greensboro shootout, the article writes as follows. According to the report, referring here to a report from the Institute for Southern Studies, a nonprofit group which monitors racist violence, according to the report, the Greensboro police used a former Klan informer for the FBI who, quote, recruited and led Klansmen to the attack on the communist demonstrators, unquote. Through the informer, Ed Dawson and others, the report said, the police monitored the organization of the communists' Death to the Klan rally for almost a month before it was held on November 3, 1979, and were told 2 weeks before the rally that a large number of Klansmen were, quote, planning to disrupt it, unquote. Well, an interesting thing, in addition to the role of Ed Dawson and the role of an undercover informant for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms named Butkovich that we're going to talk about some more in weeks to come, an interesting possible government connection to the Greensboro, North Carolina shootout concerns the presence of a man named Octavio Mandulay on the jury which initially acquitted, the communist, the Klan and Nazi group of having killed the demonstrators. Now, the case, that is, the Klansmen and Nazis are currently being charged on a federal civil rights rap, but they were acquitted of the criminal charges brought by the state in the shooting of the demonstrators. And interestingly enough, the jury foreman, the aforementioned Octavio Mandulay, was a former member of an organization which was attempting to overthrow Cuban Premier Fidel Castro and essentially was sponsored by the Bay of Pigs. This information also came to light in that very same New York Times article. Again, headlined, Police Links to Klan and Nazis Charged, run in the Chronicle, or in the San Francisco Chronicle on Saturday, October 3rd of 1981. Of Octavio Mandulay, his work as jury foreman on the jury that acquitted the Klansmen and Nazis, and his affiliation with the CIA's anti-Castro efforts, the article writes as follows. A primary criticism was that District Attorney Michael A. Schlosser, last name S-C-H-L-O-S-S-E-R, quote, allowed people to serve on the jury who admitted they held such views as, quote, it's less of a crime to kill communists, end quote. Among those selected for the jury was Octavio Mandulay, M-A-N-D-U-L-E-Y, a Cuban refugee who, the report said, was an avowed anti-communist and a member of the 20th of May organization, a group opposed to President Fidel Castro of Cuba and sponsored by the CIA. It conducted the ill-fated Bay of Pigs invasion. The Institute said that Mandulay, who was elected the jury foreman, was one of five jurors who, quote, expressed definite biases against communists and or in favor of the Klan or Nazis. And, of course, keep in mind that the subject of ex-CIA agents is a very touchy one. One never really knows whether an alleged former intelligence agent is, in fact, a former agent or is still on active duty and is simply undercover. That's always a big consideration.
Okay, and that is indeed a big consideration. We're back in the studios live. Just check this out for a moment before we continue. Here we have four Klansmen and two American Nazi Party members accused of shooting down in basically cold blood, considering that they had weapons and came to the rally with their weapons in hand. Members of the Communist Workers' Party, as we're going to talk about, allegations were made that the police and the FBI, in fact, knew all about what was going to happen, yet there were no uniformed policemen on the scene to prevent what obviously was a tragedy in the making. There was a lot of information about exactly what was going to go down. Turns out that, according to some sources, one of the people involved was, in fact, even an FBI informant who may even have escalated the entire thing.
He was definitely a Greensboro, North Carolina police informant and a former FBI informant. And according to many of the Klansmen, he actually organized the rally.
That's right. And then on top of that, when the case finally comes to court, they get an all-white, the district attorney allows an all-white jury to be picked. And on top of that, as they mentioned, five people who expressed, in fact, deep-seated dislike of communism publicly in the jury room. And supporting the Nazis and the Klan. Now, I don't know about you, but if I lived in Greensboro, North Carolina, no matter what kind of a basically good-natured and nice and even fairly open-minded person politically, and I was in a jury room and at least five of the other people were telling me the communists deserved to die and people who supported communism deserved to die and the Klan and the Nazis were a good thing, I think I would be very hesitant about casting a vote against that particular faction in the room, especially when one of them is Octavio Mandelay, who happens to be a CIA employee and part of the CIA's right-wing Cuban military milieu that's been blowing up jets and things like that for some 20 years. I think that at the very least, one could suggest that some of the people in that jury were perhaps a little bit intimidated. Should be a mild way of putting it, don't you think?
Well, certainly. I think... Of course, in a Greensboro, North Carolina jury, I wonder how hard they had to look to find diehard anti-communists. But certainly the role of government agents and people of that type certainly didn't hurt the outcome of the verdict in terms of the Klansmen.
Absolutely. And on that subject, we're going to read a little bit of an article here. This is from the New York Times for November 14th, 1982. I recognize the typeface. And the headline is Legal Moves Keep 79, meaning the year 1979, Dispute Active. Anti-Klan rally in which five died, subject of U.S. inquiry and private lawsuits. Skipping down to the middle of the article, says, shortly after the shootings, members of the American Nazi Party disclosed that Bernard Butkovich, B-U-T-K-O-V-I-C-H, an undercover agent of the Firearms Bureau, that's the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, had infiltrated the Winston-Salem chapter of the North Carolina Nazi Party in the summer of 1979. Mr. Butkovich attended planning sessions for the Klan Nazi caravan. Now, that's the caravan of Klan and Nazi members that went into a black neighborhood to where this anti-Klan rally was going on. Mr. Butkovich attended planning sessions for the Klan Nazi caravan, but did not attend the rally, conveniently for him. Nip inserts parenthetically. One defendant at the murder trial accused Mr. Butkovich of provoking violence before the rally. Officials of the Firearms Bureau have said an internal investigation cleared Mr. Butkovich of wrongdoing. On November 6, 1979, 3 days after the shootings, Andrew Peltzar, or Pelczar, P-E-L-C-Z-A-R, head of the Greensboro FBI office, stated that the Communist Workers' Party had been under investigation from October 23rd to November 2nd, 1979. Of course, November 2nd was the day before several of their members got blown away. Mr. Peltzar's superiors in Washington later denied this. Daisy Crawford, a former union organizer at Cannon Mills, that's the big company that they were doing their union organizing at, said she told the grand jury that less than a week before the slayings, two federal agents visited her home. Miss Crawford said that she told the grand jury that the agent showed her four or five pictures, including one of her friend Sandy Smith, the only black and the only woman killed at the rally. Okay, let's look at a couple of things in this article real quickly. First of all, at the very, very least, again, even for the most skeptical of you out there, we have a man, Bernard Butkovich, an undercover agent of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau, who, if he has somehow infiltrated the group, even if he didn't, as was alleged, instigate the violence, certainly knew that sending an armed caravan of Klansmen and Nazis into a Communist Workers' Party involved anti-Klan rally was asking for trouble, yet seemingly nobody got the message to anybody who could have done anything to prevent the violence. Notice also that the head of Greensboro FBI's office, Greensboro's FBI office, said that they had the CWP under investigation. Then the FBI in Washington later denied that fact. And that, thirdly, that federal agents came out and flashed a picture to one of the union organizers, and among them was one of the only black and the only woman, Sandy Smith, who was killed at the rally. Now, one of the things that's interesting about that is that in certain versions that I've heard and certain investigative bits done, there were suggestions that the Klan and the Nazi actually, Klansmen and the Nazis actually had people picked out to assassinate in the course of this. And most notably, I remember a documentary on one of the public educational television stations, I'm having real trouble talking already, suggested that in fact the Klansmen went out of their way to make sure that certain people got shot in the process of this quote-unquote riot. Which, again, was awfully staged to be a riot.
Incidentally, that special was on Frontline, and it was hosted and produced, generated, I should say, by the late Jessica Savage. And by the way, you're also listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills. But it's worth noting that Jessica Savage is not on the scene after having exposed activities like the kinds of things we're talking about here with regard to Greensboro. Okay? And so remember that the kind of scenario we see in Greensboro is exactly the kind of scenario that won the Nazi Party its popularity in Germany.
Now, while we're talking about this, and again, while we're talking about people like Bernard Butkovich and the FBI informant involved in the Viola Liuzzo case, and other people of this nature, and David Duke, if indeed he turns out to be a federal informant or a federal agent, as seems quite possible.
Or Bill Wilkinson.
Bill Wilkinson.
Or Arthur Haynes.
Frank Camper. All the others that we've been talking about in the course of this broadcast. One of the things to look at under the new unleashed Reagan administration war on heterogeneity, I guess you could say, the war on disbelief and heresy, is the way that federal agents and federal undercover operators in particular are being held responsible for the things that happen. As we've seen in the case of Bernard Butkovich, apparently everything he did was hunky-dory, despite the fact that five people were killed in what was obviously going to be probably a fatal situation that he knew about in advance. In the Viola Liuzzo case, a woman killed probably by the agent, or at least with the agent sitting in the car as the killing was going on. One of the reasons we want to know about these things is because one of the great rallying cries in the conservative to extreme right but still respectable political camp is to unleash the CIA and the FBI and let them infiltrate any sort of political group at random to quote-unquote stop terrorism. Of course, one step beyond, Hard Rain listeners know about the connections between terrorism and provoking action by the government for precisely the reasons that we've just been talking about, namely to give them a chance to infiltrate people into groups and to blame things on these groups. Anyway, with all these things in mind and the call coming out from the conservatives in this country and now increasingly even the middle of the road to allow more of this kind of infiltration to go on, we're going to read a short article from the San Francisco Chronicle for Friday, December 5th, 1980. See if this doesn't ring some bells for you. The headline is, New FBI Rules Could Allow Major Crimes by Informants. Dateline Washington. The Justice Department yesterday announced new guidelines governing use of FBI informants that might allow them to commit serious crimes in certain, quote, paramount investigations. The guidelines bar an informant from engaging in any crime without authorization or approval of an appropriate government official, unquote, presumably like Ed Meese. But they also give FBI supervisors discretion to determine whether the conduct, quote, is necessary to obtain information or evidence for paramount prosecutive purposes, unquote. Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti stressed that government agents will be bound to try to warn informants not to break the law. Let me read you that wonderful paragraph again. I like that so much. Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti stressed that government agents will be bound to try to warn informants not to break the law. Okay. And he said if a paid federal informant commits a serious crime, quote, the likelihood is that it will be reported and he will be prosecuted vigorously and no longer used as an informant, unquote. FBI Director William Webster emphasized the need for informants to probe organized crime, the Ku Klux Klan, and other elements. Skipping down. Webster said under the new guidelines, even if an informant has broken the law, the FBI would consider withholding information on the crime from local authorities if the informant's role is considered extremely valuable. He cited the case of Gary Thomas Rowe, the chief paid FBI informer in a 1960s probe of the Ku Klux Klan, who faces first-degree murder charges in connection with the 1985 slaying of Viola Gregg Liuzzo, a civil rights demonstrator who was shot to death in Alabama. Asked if the guidelines... Now, check this out, folks. You folks think that Dave and I make these things up, or even that we just stretch the truth. I know some of you do out there. Not most of you, thankfully, but some of you. Listen to this. Asked if the guidelines would have permitted Rowe to ride with Klansmen in a car on a mission to murder Liuzzo, Webster said, quote, "It's okay if he shoots to miss," unquote. But he said if Rowe shot to kill, the FBI would not be bound under the guidelines to report the slaying to local authorities if the informant's role outweighed the individual killing. Under the informal guidelines, that decision would be left to the chief of the Justice Department's criminal division with advice from the FBI. As Dave put in the original notes to this article, literally legalized murder. And as mentioned before with Ed Meese, head of the Justice Department, a man who believes, as we have talked about, and as he self-admittedly believes, that if the police arrest you, then you must be guilty. Then conceivably also, if the FBI murders you, you must be guilty too, because otherwise, why would you be involved with being murdered by the FBI? It's this kind of circular, literally insane reasoning that tends to lend a little credence to the idea of the surfacing of a real fascist ideology in this country.
Exactly. Now, you think about the viewpoint that a lot of jurors had, and that certainly many people would have, which is that it's less of a crime to kill communists. Remember now that the definition of a communist is getting looser and looser and looser. These days, a communist is anyone who opposes the Reagan line. And if you don't think that's becoming the operational definition, stick around a couple of more years and see what happens. But combine that sort of thing with that sort of guideline, which has been in effect for many years, and it becomes pretty clear that Freikorps activity and things of this type, which we've already been looking at, could be escalating drastically.
One more time, I just have to reiterate these two paragraphs, because this is an admission by the director of the FBI, who, terrifyingly enough, is one of the more progressive forces now involved in law and order in the Reagan administration. I mean, compared to some of them, he is not a screaming, blatant, right-out Nazi like some of them. Again, asked if the guidelines would have permitted Gary Thomas Rowe to ride with the Klansmen in a car on a mission to murder Liuzzo, William Webster, the head of the FBI, said it's okay if he shoots to miss, but even if he shot to kill, the FBI would not be bound to report him under the guidelines if they felt that his role as an informant outweighed the individual killing. In other words, if they decided to blow Dave and I or you and your family away, by law, their rules say they wouldn't have to report it if they felt there was something more important to be uncovered in the situation, such as anything that they wanted to come up with that they felt was more important, like communism. Think about it.
Again, do think about it, and what do you think? Do you think we should take a break now before we wind things up on them?
We want to take a short break? How many we got here left?
Let's take a short break, and then now that we've talked about the Ku Klux Klan as an extension of the government, then we will talk about the government as an extension of the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay, we're going to take, as Dave mentioned, we'll take a quick break. We'll give you about 4 minutes to get up and open a cold one and perhaps check the windows for suspicious cars parked on your front lawn with men in the back seat carrying shotguns. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with more of Radio Free America here on KFJC. And we are back in the studios at KFJC for your information in all senses of the word. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery, and we're going to be here about another 45 minutes. We're running down here into the wee hours of this 13th edition of Radio Free America, and specifically this fourth edition of Aryan Nations, tonight under the subheading of the KKK. And we got a lot of stuff to talk about in this part of the broadcast, but what we're mainly going to focus on, in case you'd like something to kind of hang the threads together in your mind, is we're going to talk about how, well, I guess you could say talking about how the Aryan Nations comes home to roost. And we talked earlier in the broadcast about how the dream of these people, when actually in the earlier broadcasts, we talked about how the dream of these people was to have their kind of guy in the White House. Originally, this dream sprung up under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and culminated in those times in a series of attempts to put together a fascist coup that would install Douglas MacArthur or Van Horn Mosley or people of that ilk in the White House. Those particular attempts did not succeed. Some of us feel that perhaps those attempts have finally borne fruit, or in this case, borne something else, namely Ronald Reagan. So, on with no further ado, we're going to get to that particular subject matter.
Alrighty, now specifically, what we're going to be looking at in with the Aryan Nations concerns... There we go, I was going to say it sounded a little stranger. Specifically, what we're going to be looking at with the Aryan Nations concerns the... with the Reagan administration, really concerns the Reagan administration as the culmination of the whole Aryan Nations development, really. We looked at the assassination of President Kennedy in terms of a military coup, in terms of the culmination of the agitation which began with the Smedley Butler coup in 1930, or attempted coup in 34, the proposed Van Horn Mosley coup in combination with the Third Reich in 39, and a growing constitutional struggle between the military and the civilian authority with regard to war-making powers. When we looked at the assassination of President Kennedy as being the culmination of that, and of course we've been looking at all of this country's political assassinations as being the same kind of program that we saw in Weimar Germany, where the underground extension of the German military wiped out the legitimate civilian leadership prior to Hitler's assumption of power. Now, what we're going to be looking at with the Reagan administration is, again, the Reagan administration as the culmination of the Aryan Nations, as sort of, in effect, a military government, a fascist government, and, again, the end product of the efforts of all of these people. Now, of course, we've looked at, in our series and in the Guns of November shows about the assassination of Kennedy, we've looked at how Ronald Reagan, along with then-legal counselor Ed Meese, helped block Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans by refusing to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans to stand trial for the assassination of President Kennedy. One thing that we have not mentioned as much on this in our broadcasts, and that we're going to take up right now, concerns the fact that Ronald Reagan also played an important role in stymieing investigations into President Kennedy's assassination when, as a member of the Rockefeller Commission investigating the CIA and alleged CIA wrongdoings, Ronald Reagan, along with the other members of the commission, found that no evidence that the CIA was involved with the Kennedy assassination, and found that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone nut assassin. Okay, just as we had been told. Information about the Rockefeller Commission and Ronald Reagan's presence on it was presented in a book called Government by Gunplay, subtitled Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today. That was put out by the Assassination Information Bureau in Boston and edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazijian, Yazijian. The book has a foreword by Philip Agee. Copyright 1976, published in softcover by Signet Books. And in the in Government by Gunplay, there's an essay called The Rockefeller Commission by co-editor Sid Blumenthal. And of the Rockefeller Commission's work, it says... The Rockefeller Commission, or Blumenthal writes, the Rockefeller Commission, which was formed to investigate the CIA, also claimed to have looked into the question of the assassination of President Kennedy. In its July 1975 report, the commission announced that it had not discovered any conspiracy and that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman, as the Warren report had stated. Well, obviously that is not the case. That represents a cover-up, and worth noting for our purposes here, one of the people who helped perpetrate this, at this point probably the third cover-up of the Kennedy assassination, the first two being the Warren Report itself, Jim Garrison's investigation, and now the Rockefeller Commission. Again, Blumenthal writes, Ronald Reagan, seeking a new stage for his acting ability after stepping down as California's governor, is on the commission as a sop to the Republican right. Well, this is the second time that Ronald Reagan played a role in deep-sixing the investigation into President Kennedy's death, and by extension, of course, deep-sixing President Kennedy.
And he's gone beyond being merely a sop to the Republican right, folks, as those of you out there who read the news and actually get out of bed have found out. The next article suggests, at least in a small way, that perhaps people who pay their dues eventually get back what they were hoping for at some point. This is a small bit of an article from the Los Angeles Times for November 10th, 1984. The headline is, Iowa Attorney Appointed to President's Art Panel, Dateline Santa Barbara, UPI Wire story. President Reagan has named David Bellin, B-E-L-I-N, a Des Moines attorney, to the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities, the White House said Friday. Bellin, age 56, served on the Warren Commission investigating President John F. Kennedy's assassination and as executive director of the Rockefeller Commission investigating the CIA.
So, a former Warren Commission member who participated in the first cover-up then chairs the Rockefeller Commission, which, surprise, surprise, covers it up again. A member of the Rockefeller Commission, then former Governor Ronald Reagan, now President Reagan, appoints former chairman of the Rockefeller Commission, David Bellin, to the President's Council Committee on the Arts and Humanities.
And again, just to refer these things back to the quote-unquote real world, what people call the real world, because sometimes, obviously, when you're dealing with the weight of information that we're dealing with, it's hard to see these things in perspective. And but again, even on the suggestion that everything was on the up and up, at the very least, it shows a massive lack of judgment to take somebody with a vested interest in the Warren Commission's viewpoint, which has already been much maligned and much attacked by the time the Rockefeller Commission was put together, to take somebody with a vested interest and make them the executive director of the Rockefeller Commission, not to mention putting people like Ronald Reagan on it, but that's even beside the point. But just again, that kind of a vested interest, making him executive director, just ensures from the start a lack of objectivity in any by anybody's way of looking at it, no matter how unwilling they are to believe the truth of these other things that we're talking about. So again, at the very least, we're looking at a deal that was queered very early on.
Okay, now, one of the people that we looked at in connection with the cover-up of the Edgar Eugene Bradley case and with regard to Jim Garrison's investigation was, of course, Ed Meese. At that time, the time that he helped cover up the Edgar Eugene Bradley situation, Ed Meese was legal advisor, legal counselor to then-Governor Ronald Reagan. Then he eventually became a White House advisor when Reagan was elected president. Now, of course, Ed Meese is the highest law enforcement official in the land. He is Attorney General of the United States, and that's not all he is. Reading now from an article from the Rebel magazine, issue of February 13th, 1984. This is from a profile of Ed Meese by Alec Dubrow, D-U-B-R-O, headlined, Edwin Meese, subtitled, Who Will Embarrass the White House Now That Watt Is Gone? And a small piece of information here about Ed Meese's background. This was true at the time that he helped cover up the Edgar Eugene Bradley situation. And we looked at that, by the way, in detail in our last Aryan Nations show, Radio Free America 12. Interestingly enough, Ed Meese is also a high-ranking officer in Military Intelligence Reserve, reading from Alec Dubrow's account from the Rebel of February 13, 84. Meese has always kept an opening to the military side of affairs, preferably the spooky side. Meese has been in the U.S. Army Reserve for years, some of that in intelligence. According to an Army CID officer, quote, Army Intelligence Reserve is not heavy cloak and dagger, but it puts the reservists in contact with regular Army intelligence. They spend 2 weeks a year on gadgets and techniques. Any civil cop would also then be able to run IDs through military and CIA sources without using regular channels. Presumably, Ed Meese has had that ability for some time. So, the highest-ranking law enforcement official in the country now, Reagan's Attorney General, is a high-ranking military reservist with connections, deep connections, running into military intelligence. And again, consider the Reagan administration as, in effect, a military governor, a government, rather.
And again, it cannot be too highly stressed that we're not talking about people who are merely suspicious because of their involvement, as Ed Meese has, their involvement with, say, military intelligence and groups of that, despite the fact there is obviously that circumstantial thing in the first place. We talked about time after time during this broadcast about the involvement of ex-intelligence and ex-military people in these very same paramilitary right-wing groups. On top of that, of course, we're talking about a Reagan administration, large segments of which is drawn directly out of that particular again, the only word I can think of is paramilitary milieu in Southern California, the Minutemen, the John Birch Society, Patrick Frawley, all of those people. The Reagan administration's people are drawn directly out of that. During the Reagan administration in California, they were tightly linked with people like Max Rafferty, who later went to work for George Wallace, and is also, I believe, involved with the National States Rights Party, if I'm not incorrect.
Max Rafferty?
Yes, I believe so.
Don't
I think
know.
He actually went to work for J.B. Stoner later on.